Whitney Media, 1460 WVOX presents The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel. Provocative conversation about world issues. Now, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Hello, welcome to our program, The Advocates, on WVOX 1460 AM. My name is Richard J. Garfunkel. I'm the host of this weekly forum. This program is coming live from New Rochelle to Queen City, located on the Long Island Sound, and it can be also heard live streaming worldwide on WVOX.com. One can also call directly the station at 914-636-0110, but please stay germane to our topic. My guest is historian, lawyer, and World War II veteran John J. McLaughlin. He's the author of the new biography of World War II General Albert Wiedemeyer, and our subject is D-Day on its 68th anniversary, its historical impact, and how it came about. As I say each week, the mission of the Advocates is to bring to the public differing views on current public policy issues. Public policy, therefore, is what we as a nation legally and traditionally follow. To that end, many of my shows are devoted to that purpose. Welcome, John McLaughlin, and his lovely wife, Mary, is also in the studio to the Advocates. And thank you for joining me at the studios of WVOX. Yeah. John McLaughlin is a practicing attorney with offices in Somerville, New Jersey, where he works with his son. The firm specializes in commercial and bankruptcy law. He's a graduate of Seton Hall University and the Seton Hall Law School. He also attended Drew University, where he earned a master's degree in literature, a master's degree in theology, magna cum laude, and a doctorate in history. Dissertation was about General Wiedemeyer, which he's now expanded into the book that I have in the desk in front of me. Mr. McLaughlin is a veteran of World War II, having served in the United States Army during the post-war occupation in Japan. Immediately following the war, after graduation from college, he served another 2 years during the Korean War as an officer, military police corps, in the capacity of assistant confinement officer, the military prison in Fort Meade, Maryland. Dr. McLaughlin is the founder and director of the New Jersey World War II Book Club. The book club meets in Millburn, New Jersey, public library. They host monthly lectures by historians and authors interested in World War II. The website of the book club is www.bookclub.blogspot.com. We'll mention that later in the program. Dr. McLaughlin is a frequent lecturer on subjects dealing with World War II. You know, today, June 6th, marks the 68th anniversary of D-Day, which began the last phase of the liberation of Nazi Germany's hold on Western Europe. The supreme commander of the Allied Expeditionary Force was General Eisenhower, and it was the largest amphibious invasion in world history, with over 160,000 troops landing on this day, June 6, 1944. There were also close to 200,000 Allied naval and merchant naval personnel and over 5,000 ships that were involved. The landings took place along a 50-mile stretch of the Normandy coast, divided into five sectors, the famous beaches Utah, Omaha, Gold, Juno, and Sword. John, please set the stage for this operation and tell us how critical its success was in determining the victory over Nazi Germany.
Yes, I'll deal with the extremely critical phase first. Keep in mind that from the time the United States got into the war, that Stalin was continually pressing for a second front. We'll talk later probably about the Prime Minister Churchill was stalling on this issue. I don't even think he ever wanted to have a cross-channel invasion. It turns out that Churchill had to give in by some arm twisting at Tehran in December 1943, the first meeting of the Big Three. But to show how critical this was, just go back in time a little bit to the beginning of 1941. At that time, the German armies held the continent from the Atlantic coast of France to the west shores of Leningrad, the Ukraine, and the shores of the Black Sea. Only Spain, Sweden, Portugal, and Switzerland were outside the Axis camp. And keep in mind, Spain was close to the Axis camp. If Franco could have gotten a little bit more out of Germany, out of Hitler, he likely would have gone with them. And if that happened, the perilous prospect of the closing of the Gibraltar Straits would have really haunted the Americans and made the later invasion of North Africa very critical. Things changed a little bit around the winter of 1942-43 at the Stalingrad reversal. But Stalin wasn't satisfied with the American offer to start a second front down in North Africa in November 42. He wanted something more. Now, so far as setting the stage is concerned, the huge buildup of forces started in England right after the war in December of 1941. And I think it's important to point out that these Allied forces which participated in D-Day were not only the United States and Britain and Canada. We had forces from Free French, Poland, Australia, Belgium, New Zealand, Netherlands, Norway, and even some from Czechoslovakia. So it really was, in essence, an Allied invasion. Another thing to keep in mind here is that June 1944, the Atlantic Wall had been enormously strengthened as a result of Rommel's being called up by Hitler. And between the summer of 1943 and June 1944, there was an enormous increase in the strength, making the D-Day invasion that much more difficult.
You know, speaking right to that point, you know, you wrote a very detailed and informative biography of General Albert C. Wiedemeyer, who, though largely forgotten today, was one of the original planners of the eventual cross-channel invasion. Who was Wiedemeyer, and what was his pivotal role regarding the eventual success of D-Day?
General Wiedemeyer was a West Point graduate. He was born 1898, died 1989 at the ripe old age of 91. He was vital intellectually and physically almost to the day he died. Graduated from West Point in the year 1917, a very interesting year. It was the last year of the First World War. And the reason they graduated in 1917 was actually a year earlier. They cut it short because they expected to get these troops, graduates, into the First World War. But he never got over to France at that time. As many during that time, the graduates, he was 17 years a lieutenant. Incidentally, Wiedemeyer didn't graduate very high in his class. The reason was not because he didn't have the intelligence, because his background and training had him headed in the direction to be a medical officer. And consequently, he didn't have much training in math. So being low in a class is an item which can hold back somebody in their career in the Army. So it took 17 years for Wiedemeyer to get a chance to redeem himself.
But John, what was his role regarding and his thinking about an earlier invasion? That's more critical to this. I mean, what did Wiedemeyer propose?
Well, Wiedemeyer was trained for 2 years at the German military academy called the Kriegsakademie. And during that period of time, he learned all the battle tactics of the Nazis. He became an expert on German warfare and became an expert on German strategy. Wiedemeyer was a true intellect. When he returned in 1938, he had a few assignments, but then in the first years of 1941, he received a critical assignment from General Marshall. As we probably know, most people know, when you come back from one of those military schools, you write a report. These reports aren't often read, but in this particular case, Wiedemeyer's report on what he learned at the Kriegsakademie was studied very carefully by General Marshall, who was the then chief of staff. And Marshall called Wiedemeyer in for conferences at his office, one-on-one, during the early years of early months of 1941. And as a result, as a from Marshall's appointment, he became chairman of a group in the War Plans Department, which designed what was called the Victory Plan. And this Victory Plan had three components to it. Keep in mind that we're talking about the spring of 1941. We're not in war yet. But FDR wanted us to prepare for war. This Victory Plan called for a buildup of the armed forces to 10 million, the increase in industrial production by the civilian economy of a huge amount to supply all these troops, and more importantly than anything, actual battle plans. These were plans.
I know, but John, you know, we're running down on time here. What he came up with a plan to go cross-channel in 1943. What happened to that plan? Why was it postponed for a year?
Yes, Wedemeyer's plan was to have a cross-channel invasion into France in 1943. That plan was accepted by Marshall, approved by the president, and was all set to go. The only hitch was we had to get approval from our main ally, Great Britain. Great Britain, and when we say Great Britain here, we're talking about one person. We're talking about Churchill. Churchill never wanted to invade France in 1943, and if you study the history carefully, he probably never wanted to invade France at all.
Well, that's the interesting point. I think that's the critical point of this, that it was put off. We're going to get into that a little later. My guest is historian, lawyer, World War II veteran John McLaughlin, author of a new biography of World War II General Albert Wedemeyer. Our subject is D-Day on its 65th anniversary, its historical impact, how it came back. You're listening to The Advocates on WVOX Radio 1460, live streaming on WVOX. We've got to go to a financial news break. We'll be back in a second.
With business news at 20 minutes past the hour, every hour, here's the latest update from the Fox Business Network on WVOX Worldwide.
From the Fox Business Network, the rally on Wall Street growing strong. Investors are hopeful world leaders will take action to stimulate the global economy at 12 p.m. Eastern Time. The Dow is up 211 points. Home Depot shares are up after the nation's largest home improvement retailer boosted its share buyback program by $500 million. Home Depot now expects to repurchase about $4 billion in shares this year. The company also affirming its full-year earnings and revenue guidance. And the home of the Whopper is expanding in Russia. Burger King reached a deal with its Russian franchise operator to open several hundred new locations there in the next few years. This is in addition to the 57 BKs it already has in Russia. The world's second largest burger chain has been boosting its presence in emerging markets as the fast food industry becomes increasingly saturated here in the U.S. With the Fox Business Report, I'm Lauren Simonetti.
Hi, I'm a home. The one with the roof, walls, and all the things that make me yours. Things like your comfy couch, entertainment center, and that lamp you just couldn't live without. These are the things that you could lose in a flood. And homeowners insurance doesn't cover floods. Even just a few inches of water in your home can cost you tens of thousands of dollars. But in moderate to low-risk areas, flood insurance starts as low as $129 a year. Visit floodsmart.gov to learn what a flood could cost you.
We're making the workday fun.
Just fun to listen to.
AM 1460, WVOX, New Rochelle, and WVOX Worldwide.
1460, WVOX.
Now, back to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to The Advocates and my guest, John J. McLaughlin, the author of the new biography of World War II General Albert Wedemeyer. And our subject is D-Day on its 68th anniversary, its historical impact, and how it came about. You're listening to The Advocates on WVOX Radio 1460 AM and live streaming on WVOX. And of course, this is the anniversary of D-Day. We've been mentioning Albert Wedemeyer, a great planner, an early planner regarding D-Day. His idea to have a cross-channel invasion at the Pas-de-Calais, which would have been only 20 miles from England, directly into the heart of Germany. And, of course, the problem and the debate over this the approval by the Americans, the rejection by our main ally, the Brits, and their leader, Winston Churchill. You know, getting to this and D-Day exactly, John, Dwight D. Eisenhower was a virtual unknown brigadier general at the time of Pearl Harbor. He was outranked by hundreds of other generals in a relatively small U.S. Army at the age of 51. He also never experienced combat in his almost 30 years of active duty. What was the reason why Eisenhower's meteoric rise, and why was he eventually appointed Supreme Commander?
Well, I guess the short answer is there really was a contest only between two people for the job. One was, of course, Eisenhower, and the other was General Marshall. And President Roosevelt, I think, emotionally was really interested in having Marshall, but it came down to the fact that he simply couldn't part with Marshall, who was so important on the home front. Mm. Now, Ike had, although no actual battle experience, he came well prepared. He worked under MacArthur. Don't forget, he was in charge of the Operation Torch, the invasion of North Africa. And I think probably the main reason was he was a man who knew how to get along with their allies. That was the key thing here. There were other people who may have been just as competent in strategic and tactical planning, but we needed somebody who could bridge the gap between the British and the Americans.
And, you know, that leads to a very interesting point. There is and was always friction between allies, no less partners, with seemingly common objectives. Today, many of the differences regarding Britain and ourselves have been forgotten under the umbrella phrase special relationship. John, what were some of the differences, and how did Eisenhower handle them?
Well, I think the first big difference in philosophy between the Americans and the British was imperialism. Churchill famously said, "I'm not going to preside over the dissolution of the British Empire," and of course, FDR was totally against imperialism. Other differences had a lot to do with, and probably the biggest one was on air strategy, and maybe we can talk about that later. The proponents of air strategy, both incidentally, I include the Americans also, General Carl Spatz for the Americans and Sir Arthur Bomber Harris for the British, they wanted to be independent. They wanted total control over the targets, how it was controlled. And Eisenhower was Supreme Commander. He actually at one point threatened to resign unless he was given control of the bombing, because it was essential for him to control the bombing of the rail junctions, and the strategic bomber commanders were not interested in doing that.
Mm. You know, the renowned historian Andrew Roberts, who has been a guest on The Advocates, has written in his book Masters and Commanders that Roosevelt, Churchill, and their chief respective military officers, George Marshall, of course, and Field Marshal Alan Brooke, were the chief architects of both strategy and victory. You seem to be quite critical of Churchill with regards to the European phase of the war. Could you elaborate that perspective, especially dealing with his idea of the soft underbelly of the Axis?
Right. I think for a variety of reasons, Churchill was not really, in my opinion, the great strategist that he thought he was. And he actually, in my judgment, was deceptive when dealing with the Americans with regard to what he wanted to do. He was able to sell President Roosevelt on the Operation Torch, which was the invasion of North Africa in November of 1942, but he withheld. And Andrew Roberts, in his book, is the first one to admit this, that he withheld the fact that in the back of his mind he had the invasion of Sicily and the entire invasion of Italy as subsequent attacks. And all this was designed to forestall, if not even prevent, an invasion in France. Mm. And Churchill later on said Italy was a very good prize and we didn't risk too much by it. He's absolutely wrong. The soldiers who landed at Salerno and Anzio would be the first to say these all wet about that. And keep in mind one final thing. Rome wasn't entered until one day before D-Day,
right.
June 6, 1944.
Well, and of course, the whole Italian campaign is a very complex and difficult one regarding Mark Clark and Harold Alexander and divided command, etc. One of the criticisms, of course, of the cross-channel plan was they felt that the American troops had not been blooded, we did not have enough equipment ready, etc. But we can discuss that. Before our break, there's always been a conflict between civilian and military control of strategy, and there's always been a domestic politics in both America and Britain have influences. Was Wiedemeyer a victim of domestic politics, you believe?
He certainly was when it came to the underutilization of this man who had enormous skills. I mentioned earlier that he was trained at the German War Academy. He learned about the Nazis. He actually was the only American, as a matter of fact, the only foreigner who ever had the opportunity to command a German panzer division, albeit in a practice role.
And he spoke German, too.
And he spoke German. He knew the German officers. This was a man who many historians say should have been involved in the European invasion and the cross-channel invasion, should have been involved in the planning for it, but he was shunted off to Asia. Why?
So he called for the 1943 invasion instead of Normandy, where we all know about Pas-de-Calais, from Dover, the short distances. He called for that. Churchill objected to that. Churchill was not interested in bleeding his army at that stage of the game, and he's transported off to China. That's where the European war ends for General Wiedemeyer. We have to go to a break in a little while. My guest is historian, lawyer, and World War II veteran John J. McLaughlin, the author of the new biography of World War II General Albert Wiedemeyer. Our subject is D-Day on its 68th anniversary, its historical impact, and how it came about. You're listening to The Advocates on WVOX, VOX Radio, and live streaming at WVOX.com. And right before, remember, of course, D-Day is this critical, critical event, but we're going to go to a break for a short few moments right now.
Here's the latest update from Fox News Radio on WVOX Worldwide.
Fox News Radio, I'm Lillian Wu, the author who early on anticipated iPods, interactive television, and even televised police pursuits, has died.
Ray Bradbury's stories covered a mix of genres, science fiction, fantasy, gothic horror. His writing chilled and sparked the imagination. Fahrenheit 451, The Illustrated Man, The Martian Chronicles, among his best-known works. Bradbury died in Southern California at the age of 91.
Fox Radio's Hank Weinblum, fresh off his recall election victory, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker says it's time to try and work together.
Meanwhile, RNC Chairman Reince Priebus says the vote has national implications.
I think the Democrats are going to have a little bit of a circular firing squad on their hands.
But the White House says Walker outspent Barrett. The electorate will be different in November, and President Obama's economic message will resonate here in the Badger State.
Fox Radio's Jennifer Kiefer, Fox News. We report, you decide.
Our community programs are brought to you today by Young & Bartlett, Westchester's leading law firm for negligence, personal injury cases, and medical malpractice. Relying on 55 years of legal experience, partner Francis X. Young and his legendary father before him have been great advocates, recovering millions of dollars for those unfortunate individuals who were injured in any way, including victims of medical malpractice, construction job site accidents, motor vehicle accidents, or defective products. Young and Bartlett are actual trial attorneys who stand right up for you and your rights in the courtroom. Partner Mayo Bartlett of this top-notch firm also specializes in civil rights cases and criminal defense. Calling on his many years as assistant DA under famed crime fighters Carl Vergari and Janine Pirro. Today, Young & Bartlett is at 81 Main Street in White Plains at Lexington, two blocks from Metro North. Attorneys Frank Young and Mayo Bartlett. Two great lawyers, two dedicated advocates. Check them out at young-bartlett.com or by calling 914-285-1500.
Now with your latest up-to-date forecast, here's Steve Pelletieri's Eye on Weather, exclusively on WVOX Worldwide.
Forecast Westchester County in the vicinity for this afternoon. We'll see partly sunny skies. Could be some scattered showers and thunderstorms later today. Highs will climb into the lower 70s. Mostly cloudy. A few showers and thunderstorms this evening. Overnight lows into the upper 50s. Partly sunny. Chance of a shower thunderstorm on Thursday into the middle 70s. Clouds and sunshine. Chance of more thunderstorms, especially in the morning on Friday. Friday's highs climbing near 80. Partly sunny. Lower 80s. Saturday looks dry for Sunday as well. Steve Pelletieri, Jr. reporting for WVOX Worldwide and WVIP HD.
I know what you did last summer.
Yeah, same thing we're doing this summer. Having the most fun on the radio. WVOX Worldwide.
1460 WVOX.
Now, back to the Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to the Advocates. My guest, John J. McLaughlin, the author of the new biography of World War II, General Albert Wiedemeyer, a great planner in the American Army. Our subject is D-Day on its 68th anniversary, its historical impact, how it came about. You're listening, of course, to The Advocates on WVOX 1460 AM radio, live streaming at WVOX.com. John, the eventual invasion of Europe, whether it was accomplished in Sicily, Italy, at the Pas-de-Calais in 1943 in France, or Normandy in 44, was a critical result of the need for a second front and the giving relief to the Soviets, who were paying for each mile of territory with hundreds of thousands of lives. Was there an attitude among the British to allow the Germans and Russians to bleed themselves white?
I would have to say the answer to that question is probably a yes, but it's very difficult in the history books to get anyone to ever admit that. But when you consider the years of Great Britain in dealing with European politics, their overriding principle was to maintain the balance of power. Britain wanted France to be a power, and consequently, the two biggest obstacles to the British retention of power at that time in 1941-42 would have been Russia and Germany. Mm-hmm. And if they came down a couple of pegs, all the better.
Right. You know, with the lesson of World War One, when the Russians signed a separate peace treaty with the Germans at Brest-Litovsk, was there a legitimate Allied fear of a Soviet collapse along with the threat of a shift of millions of German troops to the Western Front?
Absolutely. And that it can be documented very clearly in reading the original documentations of the War Department, which have been now declassified. That changed, of course, with the Battle of Stalingrad in the winter of 1942-1943, when it appeared as though the tide would change. And at that point, there was no fear of a Russian collapse. But in some quarters, there was a little bit of a fear of perhaps a settlement of the war between Germany and Russia. But as it turns out from reading the history books, I don't think that was a realistic possibility.
You know, even the Allies considered in 1943 that any cross-channel invasion of France should come at Calais, only 20 miles from England. Certainly, Germans considered invading Britain from that spot. Allied planners also believed that a successful landing there would help them launch a shorter strike into the heart of Germany. John, the Allies deceived the Germans into believing that Calais was the obvious target. How important was that deception?
I don't think the invasion could have been successful except for the enormous amount of deception, which fortuitously was pretty much accepted. And this took several levels. One was fake equipment, a fake army under General Patton. You know, all of this was, I think, disclosed in these war movies. Mm-hmm. Several double agents, fraudulent radio transmission, feints. All of which, it turns out, really did keep the Germans off balance, and certainly it kept Hitler from disposing his tanks.
So in lieu of that, in regards to that, what were the consequences regarding German delays in mobilization? Did that help the beachhead at Normandy?
Absolutely, it prevented many of the German panzer tanks from getting up to the beaches. It allowed an opportunity for the Americans previously, who had destroyed many of the rail centers, to get their troops there, and also the delay in Hitler in giving authority to his two main generals to advance his troops. All of these things work to the Allies' advantage. Mm.
You know, before we go to a break, and I think we have a caller, we're going to try to get that call in. John, with the success of the deception, with the massive 50-mile-wide beach secured, the push inland in progress, we still had considerable problems making a strategic breakout into France. John, why did it take the Allies weeks to take Cherbourg and almost through July to take the crossroads town of Saint-Lô? What was the problem? Was it topography?
I think that was part of it. The British prided themselves on having an enormous amount of information for the invasion. I talk in a book about their famous red leather folders, which they would open up at strategic meetings and talk about all of the where the troops were located and so on and so forth. The one thing those red folders did not contain was the location of the hedgerows and how difficult it would be.
Especially for tanks to break through.
Absolutely.
And then they learned to put these metal pieces on and dig through. It's an amazing story. We have a caller. Maybe our caller has a question to ask. Could you mention your name and your question, please?
Yes, sir. This is Alex, Mr. Garfunkel. It's a great program. Mr. McLaughlin, thank you for your service, and I'm glad you're here to talk about it. Appreciate you, sir. I want to ask you, did an argument ever break out among strategists and generals to the effect that, hey, why are we invading Europe? We've got bombed at Pearl Harbor. Doesn't this weaken it that we have to open up the front? And how come we can't let the Soviets do the dirty work in Europe? And did then a strategic argument ever break out to a two-front war?
Thank you. Thank you, Alex, for the question.
Well, okay. The answer to that is absolutely yes. There was disagreement among the generals. Remember, after December 7, 1941, the rallying cry was, remember Pearl Harbor. You didn't hear anybody yell, remember Poland. A good portion of the American military would have been very content to send a lot of these forces, ammunition, troops, and so on, over to whip Japan. And that was something which very, very much concerned Churchill. And Churchill was able to convince us to do Europe first.
Yeah. Okay. Also remember, Alex, Germany declared war on the United States on December 10th, one of the great mysteries of history. So by
very
declaring
good point, yeah.
war on the United States and understanding that Germany was a much greater threat to world peace and the survival of America and Japan was almost like a second issue, we had the policy of Germany first.
Yeah. Anything? My final question is, that's a great point. Was General Patton basically alone reading that book by Rommel on infantry attacks, or was that kind of a high-level officer thing that a lot of them read, or was he sort of like the lone wolf on that?
There's not much mention that I have come across of other people studying Rommel as much as Patton did.
Wow, that's amazing.
Well,
all right.
Thank you very much. Remember,
wonderful. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you for the call. Excellent calls. Remember one thing. There were a number of high-level people in a number of armies who were interested in mechanized warfare. And in Germany, Rommel and others were involved in mechanized warfare. They saw the effect of the tank in the First World War. You had Patton. You also had de Gaulle, who was very much informed on mechanized warfare. A lot of people don't realize that. So there has been, you know, it's not like information is in a vacuum, but certainly during World War II, there were some people who always are fighting the tactics of the last war, and there was great fears of trench warfare, remember, in even repeating itself. John, in our last few moments before the break, wasn't that the British concern over the loss of life at Passchendaele of the British and Ypres and these huge bloodletting battles of the First World War?
Again, I want to say that when we talk about the British fear, I substitute the word Churchill. Remember, Churchill was the author of the invasion of the Dardanelles, which turned out to be a huge British disaster in the First World War. and set Churchill back on his heels. He did recover from that, of course, but I don't think he ever forgot that. And he, of course, he never forgot the First World War, the trench warfare, and Passchendaele. Churchill, on many occasions, said in his opposition to the cross-channel invasion, the channel is going to be a river of blood. And this was behind his opposition. And as I said earlier, I really think that if Churchill could have avoided a cross-channel invasion at any time, he would have done it.
Now, can the war against Germany be won only by the Soviets, and could it be won without an invasion?
Good question. With all of the support that we gave Russia and the progress they were making, I think eventually they might have been able to do it, but it would have had a serious negative impact on
Western Europe.
Europe. As a matter of fact, you know, one of the reasons Wedemeyer wanted to invade France in 1943 was to beat the Russians to the Eastern Front and prevent the land grabs which they took. If we didn't invade, eventually Stalin would have made it all the way to Marseille.
Well, you know, it's a very interesting point about are the American and the British view of Sovietization of Europe, you know, whether Eastern Europe, of course, that's been debated since the days of Yalta. It will be continue to be debated, and it's not an unusual subject to digress about. The problem of Eastern Europe, the problem of Eastern Europe remained for 40 years after the war, and to a degree it continues today. My guest is historian and lawyer, World War II veteran John J. McLaughlin, the author of the new biography of World War II General Albert Wiedemeyer. We've been talking about D-Day on the 68th anniversary, its historical impact, how it came about. You're listening to The Advocates on WVOX Radio, live streaming. We're going to go to a break.
With world and national news three times an hour, here's the latest update from Fox News Radio on WVOX Worldwide.
Fox News Radio, I'm Lillian Wu, the author who early on anticipated iPods, interactive TV, and even televised police pursuits, has died.
Ray Bradbury's stories covered a mix of genres, science fiction, fantasy, gothic horror. His writing chilled and sparked the imagination. Fahrenheit 451, The Illustrated Man, The Martian Chronicles, among his best-known works.
Must burn the books, Montag.
And that's from the film version of Fahrenheit 451. Bradbury died in Southern California at the age of 91.
Fox Radio's Hank Weinblum, fresh off his recall election victory, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker saying it's time to try and work together.
Meanwhile, RNC Chairman Reince Priebus says the vote has national implications.
I think the Democrats are going to have a little bit of a circular firing squad on their hands.
But the White House says Walker outspent Barrett. The electorate will be different in November, and President Obama's economic message will resonate here in the Badger State.
Fox Radio's Jennifer Kuiper, Fox News. We report, you decide.
Recently, some people have had questions about the plants that generate our electricity here in New York. You have a right to know the facts about one of the most important providers of power to our area. Did you know that Indian Point provides about a quarter of the electricity for New York City and Westchester, with virtually no emissions and at lower cost? Indian Point's operations are constantly reviewed to ensure safety by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. It's among the most thoroughly reviewed nuclear energy facilities in the country, and that there are multiple federal inspectors on site, and the law guarantees them access to any document, any employee, and any portion of the facility. That's accountability, every day, all the time. I'm Teresa Motko, and I'm an engineer here at Indian Point, and my family and I live in the area. All of us have a right to know why Indian Point is right for New York. Visit rightfornewyork.com for answers.
The most innovative and groundbreaking local transportation service is now here. The Green Team Cab Corporation in New Rochelle. The one and only Green Team Cab Corporation features all new 2011 super luxurious hybrid cars that really make you feel like you're being driven in style and comfort. The Green Team is perfect for all your corporate needs. A trip to the airport or just a ride anywhere locally. Call Brian Herbie or Mr. O'Mara today at the Green Team Cab Corporation in New Rochelle for a new kind of luxury transportation experience. experience second to none. We love the Green Team and you will too. 914-576-1200 and New Rochelle 576-1200. Credit cards accepted in the car, no minimums, no forced gratuity. 576-1200, the Green Team, now the most innovative and superior way to travel. The Green Team, saving the planet one ride at a time.
Dry cleaning. You know, ladies and gentlemen, I have a real thing about this, and I've been telling you for years that when it comes to custom quality dry cleaning, you know, where you get your clothes back in perfect shape without that awful chemical cleaning smell, there's only really one dry cleaner that I know of in all of Westchester you can always count on. Scott Solomon Solo Clean. It's on the Post Road in Mamaroneck, New York. So if you want your valuable clothes returned in like new, pristine condition without that awful commercial cleaning smell, please try Solo Clean. The cost for their professional custom handling is really, incidentally, really the same you're probably paying right now. Solo Clean in Mamaroneck, New York on the Post Road. They're the best dry cleaner in Westchester. I'll go up against anybody on that claim.
Looking for a tail-wagging way to support the fight against cancer? Then leash up your pooch and join the American Cancer Society's Bark for Life on Sunday, June 10th at Lyndhurst in Tarrytown. Together, we'll create a world with less cancer and more barks by celebrating canine caregivers, remembering loved ones lost, and fighting back against cancer. Visit us at relayforlife.org/barkwestchesterny or call 914-397-8827. That's relayforlife.org/barkwestchesterny or 914-397-8827.
Here, there, and everywhere.
Every day, every night.
We're number one for fun.
At work, at home.
WVOX Worldwide.
1460 WVOX.
Now, back to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to The Advocates and my guest, John J. McLaughlin, author of the new biography of World War II, General Albert Wiedemeyer. Our subject is D-Day on its 68th anniversary and its historical impact. Of course, you listen to The Advocates on WVOX 1460 radio and live streaming on WVOX.com. You know, obviously D-Day succeeded with overwhelming naval and air support, protecting the sea lanes from any threat by the Kriegsmarine, the German Navy, of course, massive air superiority dominating the skies and French resistance groups destroying rails, electricity, and communication lines. The expanding Allied armies' march to Germany was seen as almost a foregone conclusion. By June 6th, General Wiedemeyer, the author of the Victory Program, which you write so extensively about, was long gone from Britain. Where did he wind up, John?
In October 1943, he was sent to Asia to be the chief of staff of Lord Louis Mountbatten, who was in charge of what was called then the Southeast Asia Command. Wiedemeyer stayed there for a year, and in the meantime, General Stilwell, who was in China, was getting into a jam with Chiang Kai-shek, which was going on for several years. And finally, Stilwell just overstepped his bounds, and Chiang Kai-shek, the leader of the Chinese, demanded his recall. And that meant that in October 1944, that Wiedemeyer took over in China for General Stilwell.
You know, as you related in your book and as you mentioned now, Wiedemeyer was thrust into the vortex of another firestorm involving powerful individuals, Chiang Kai-shek, Mao Zedong, Chou Enlai, Joe Stilwell, Claire Chennault, head of the former Air Force, the Chinese Volunteer Air Force, and then the American Air Force Ambassador Pat Hurley and others. What were your impressions of Wiedemeyer's mission to China and the eventual fall of Chiang and the Kuomintang nationalists? Could it have been prevented?
I think the irony of Wiedemeyer being sent to Asia is that his performance in China in the long run was far more significant than what he had done in the preparation for the plans for the invasion of France. But ironically, that also has been overlooked in the history books. And in my opinion, and I write about this in the book, if the United States had given adequate support to Chiang Kai-shek And we're not talking about a lot of military troops now. We're talking about money. We're talking about some advisory personnel and equipment. If those things had been provided to Chiang Kai-shek during the critical years of 1944 up to 1948, Chiang Kai-shek, in my judgment, and then certainly in the opinion of Wedemeyer, Chiang Kai-shek would have defeated Mao Zedong. And just pause for a moment and think about what that would have meant in the world picture. Assuming that happened, we would not have had a Korea, and we would not have had a Vietnam War, and we would be living in a much different world today.
Mm. You know, speaking of Wedemeyer, who is basically forgotten today, I mean, thank you, we can thank you for this book on him. What got you interested in him?
Well, when you get your doctorate degree, you have to write a dissertation. And I always wanted to write about war. I've been interested in war as a military man for many, many years. And it so happened that we took a long-awaited D-Day trip in the year 2005. And in preparing for that, I read a book, which I mentioned very favorably, by John Keegan called Six Armies in Normandy. John Keegan,
very well-known book.
Very well-known book. A great, great writer. Incidentally, John Keegan is very ill now. I've been communicating with him over the years about Wedemeyer. He's been very generous with his time. And in any event, I decided to write about Wedemeyer when I came back because of John Keegan's book, because Keegan talks about Wedemeyer writing the battle plans for the invasion of France and the most important document of World War II. So when I got to France on the D-Day trip, I asked about him. None of these very knowledgeable instructors knew anything about Wedemeyer. Mm. And I said, there has got to be a story here. And that was the genesis.
Mm. You know, in closing, we have a few minutes left, and getting back to D-Day, which happened 68 years ago today. And quite often, even D-Day is starting to fade into historical memory. What, in your role as a veteran and a person with a long historical perspective, made the whole thing work? Was it logistics, manpower, planning, deception, bravery? Tell us, give us an oversight of how D-Day succeeded.
I would say, Richard, all of those things. And I wouldn't want to single out one of those elements and say that one element was the most important. I think it was a combination. But I would have to say that it was the bravery of the men who invaded those beaches on June 6, 1944, that in the final analysis really turned the tide.
Mm, yeah, and they certainly were on all the beaches. Yeah, I want to thank you, John McLaughlin, for joining me today. And in the final second or two, remind our audience about the New Jersey World War II Book Club, how it started in your role.
Thank you very much, Richard.
What about your role in the New Jersey Book Club and how it started?
I started the World War II Book Club because when I began to do my dissertation, I wanted to keep up my interest. So I said, I think I'll join a book club. I called about 20 or 25 libraries in northern New Jersey, and I was told, not only do we not have any, one of two librarians said, I don't think there's much interest in World War II anymore. And that really got me angry. Mm. So I said, if we don't have a World War II book club, I'm going to start one. And we started it 3 years ago. It's been very successful. We meet monthly at the Milburn Library in Milburn, New Jersey, and we host authors and historians who write about World War II.
And as you want to hear this broadcast or any of the other archived broadcasts in the Advocates, you can access on my website, advocates-wvox.com, where information my guests we posted, information on John's book club, and I want to repeat it. The website, www.bookclub.blogspot.com. You'll see that on my website, advocates-wvox. You can listen to the program again, hear things you want, and you right there will be able to contact the book club. You may be interested in going there, talking to the members of it. Next week, the Advocates will host Alfred Zakar, the author of Presidential Power in a Troubled Second Term, and we'll be discussing 20th century presidential failure in the second term. We got a minute or so left, John. today, looking at our involvement all over the world, are we able to, are we making progress, or without the large enemy of the Soviet bloc to deal with, do you see a problems for us going forward in sort of divisions within the Allies? How do you see that as a lesson of World War II?
Well, I'm going to respond to that in terms of how I think Wedemeyer would have reacted to this. It's awfully difficult to mount what we call a counterfactual argument, but I would say, based upon everything that I've read about Wedemeyer, and that's been extensive, he never would have been in favor of any huge massing of military forces, armed forces, in a foreign country, unless we had the full support of all of the Allies, as we did in World War II. Mm. I think he would have been against any of these attacks on these countries that didn't have support.
Now, bringing it right to modern-day alliance, the first Gulf War. We had a huge amount of men. We had a large amount of allies, even in the Middle East, even Syria. How come that wasn't brought to a conclusion then? Quick answer. You got 10 seconds.
A political decision was made not to advance up to Baghdad.
And you know what? As we learn in history, history is a horrible teacher quite often. Maybe all the problems we have today could have been solved right there. I want to thank again John McLaughlin for coming on. You can hear this broadcast in any of the archived Advocate broadcasts on advocates-wvox. Next week we'll be talking about the failure of presidential power in the second term. Have a great day, and thank you very much for joining us. Richard Garfunkel on the Advocates.
The Advocates on 1460 WVOX.